Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On tonight's program, we look back at some of the best stories we featured in 2003. There was the Danville Community Encyclopedia, the high school student who studied the 5-second rule, the guys who created International Talk Like a Pirate Day, the locally produced Renaissance Fair, and much more. So keep it tuned here for the best of 2003 Sidetrack. If you don't know what a zine is, well, you're probably not alone. Zines are small circulation publications, we're talking between a few dozen and a few thousand copies per issue, usually put out by an individual. They cover everything from music to politics to personal experiences, and for the most part, are still printed on paper. They can be found in record stores, coffee shops, and other out-of-the-way places. In May, the Independent Media Center, or IMC in Urbana, held a get-together for these zine writers and editors to read their work out loud and to compare notes. Jason Pitzel Waters, a member of the IMC, was there and talked to the participants about zines.
It's a sunny spring afternoon at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. In the back room, among rows of chairs, are about a dozen people waiting for today's so-called zine slam to begin. In front is an empty microphone and PA system. Near the back is a table lined with different zines available for purchase.
This event has been known by numerous names. I often just call it the IMC Zine Reading.
That's Ellen Knutson, a self-proclaimed radical librarian of the IMC Librarians Group.
But because it's snazzier on posters, we've also called it the IMC Zine Slam, although there's no real competition involved, just a good time of independent publishers reading from their publications, which are known as zines. And the topics that people are reading about are pretty wide, some serious, some funny and serious.
She is one of the organizers of this event. The other is Brent Ritzel, a Chicago-based writer and editor who publishes The Zine Guide, a resource and clearinghouse of information on hundreds of zines and underground publications circulating throughout the country. So far, Ritzel is nowhere to be seen. Word has it he is a little late due to traffic, so they start without him.
That night we were traveling the roads between the crops. The crops are always the same, soybeans and corn, alternating yearly in fields that stretch farther than an eye can see, a steady oscillation between two types of produce. We were always happiest the years when corn grew behind the cemetery, when it grew so tall.
The IMC's Zine Slam is a chance for local and regional creators of zines to get together and read their work to and interact with an audience they rarely get to see. Zines, a shortcut way of saying magazines, are small print publications that mirror the unique and idiosyncratic voices of their creators. Some have glossy covers and look like low-cost versions of your standard newsstand publications. A majority of them are basically Xerox pages folded and stapled together. Finally, the traffic-delayed Ritzel arrives. In his arms, a large cardboard box filled with zines. He takes over the microphone to keep things going in full swing.
For the last 5 or 6 years, I've been publishing the Zine Guide. It's kind of like a resource guide to 1,000 or so independent publications. And for almost 12 years, I've been publishing Tailspins, which is kind of normal zine fare. I end up not writing enough pieces for Tailspins, but one piece that kind of absorbed a couple months of my life was on the assassination of JFK, John F. Kennedy. Actually, my current girlfriend, she was born on his assassination day, so I'm kind of excited. I started off originally planning just writing a piece on assassinations in general.
Ritzel has also organized readings in Chicago as well as in Urbana. Today's reading is the second in what they hope will be an ongoing series. Ritzel feels that these events not only help the zine community, but the zine creators themselves.
Most zinesters kind of sit at home and write their stuff and don't interact enough with people, so part of it is kind of forcing zinesters to get out and meet each other and, you know, to build a community, to bring together like-minded people. I guess I've always had a tendency towards wanting to do that because I've noticed that people don't naturally do that. And also, you know, it improves writing. It forces you to write as a reader. As this is something I'm going to have to read live, and people are going to be responding to me. So I think it really kind of, you know, forces people to hone in on kind of more interesting writing because they're writing for reading, which is a bit of a different thing. But I think it's a good challenge, you know, to kind of alter people's writing approach in some ways. Well, and also just to promote zines, to let people out there, more out there, know that they exist. And, you know, it's kind of trying to use the band model. You know, it's like, you know, bands go out there and tour. Why can't zinesters? And that's been happening more and more.
Yeah, I do Low Hug, which is a popular culture per zine, and it explores the intersection between the popular and the personal. To co-opt a phrase, the personal is the popular.
The person in front of the microphone right now is A.J. Michael, creator, as she mentioned, of the zine called Low Hug. She feels these zine readings are a good way for fellow writers and editors to meet.
It's nice for zine editors and writers to come out of their holes and away from their computers and their drawing tables and their glue sticks to actually see that each other exists. And these zine readings are a good way to just meet other people and spread the word.
Whereas most read directly from their zines, Michael is reading from computer-printed pages. She is holding the microphone in her hands and pacing back and forth.
Sometimes I think I'd like to work in television, but then I come to my senses and I file that away along with all the other cool jobs I covered. Coffee house owner, package designer, radio producer, Zamboni driver. So when I was in Las Vegas a few months ago, one event I insisted on, besides the 99-cent shrimp cocktails at the Golden Gate Casino, was to go to CBS Television City in the MGM Grand and participate in their viewer focus groups, where you watch and rate some sort of in-development program.
Most of those in the audience today are also zine creators. They will all take their turn in front of the microphone, just like Michael. Zines, while coming into popularity in the early 90s, have, according to Michael, been around for much, much longer.
Zines actually started in the 20s in the sci-fi community, basically fandom, you know, their own fiction, things like that. And then it grew throughout the 40s, 50s, 60s. In the 70s, the punk zine started. In the 80s, with the start of the now late Fact Sheet 5, that started, you know, the first major modern, for lack of a better word, zine revolution. I think the zine popularity that we saw a spike of in the early 90s was basically caused by, I mean, they had always been out there. It was just the media, the mainstream media, finally got a hold of it. And I'll never forget watching when CNN did an hour about Generation X, and they said, you know, and they published these little magazines called zines, which I just thought was really lame.
In the age of the internet, when everyone seems to have a virtual soapbox to voice their opinions, what is the relevancy of zines in the days of the weblogs and other easy-to-use journal programs? Why do people still publish the paper version? For people like Low Hug editor Michael, it is the love of doing their own physical layout and design.
I'm a covert designer at heart. I've never had any training, but I love fonts, and I could sit in front of the computer for hours. I have lots of friends who are frustrated writers, and for me, the word doesn't look the same for me. I don't think it has the same impact on the computer screen as on a piece of paper.
Other people have more practical reasons, like Brad Bugos, editor of Silly Little Trouser Monkeys, and a participant in today's slam.
Because you can't take the internet in the bathroom. People had to have stuff to read in the bathroom, and my idea was not all everybody spends half an hour to an hour in there like I do, so they need something short to read, so that's where I come in. So I think that fills a space that a lot of magazines have too many articles, long articles, or books.
Zine guide and Tailspin editor Ritzel also thinks along the same lines.
The physical medium, the ability to read it on the toilet or the bus or in your bed and stuff, you can never underestimate how important that is. And it's hard to do that with a computer and the internet, at least at this point. But even though, you know, it's a lot more painful to look at all those photons shooting at you than just kind of the reflection of photons, I guess. I think it's easier on the eyes. And the bottom line is people thought that the zine world would plummet with the internet, but I can only name you a couple dozen zines that switch from a print format to strictly the internet format, whereas like 2/3 of all print zines have web pages. So it's just like, it's only enhancing. It's just another tool to get it out there and to better promote it.
So it seems most people do zines because they love doing what they do, despite the fact that most don't make any money from their production. In fact, most barely break even on their endeavors, so it really is an inner drive and a love for the print medium that keeps zines alive in a virtual culture. Judging from this event, the Zine Slam seems to have a positive effect linking fellow zine creators and exposing them to a new audience as well. Future local zine slams are scheduled at the IMC in the months to come. For Sidetrack, I'm Jason Pitzel-Waters.
You've got attuned to the best of 2003 Sidetrack. Now, one of the stories that really captured people's attention this year was a study done by Julian Clark, a senior at the Chicago High School for Agricultural Sciences. She spent her summer here at the University of Illinois studying the so-called five-second rule. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's the unofficial rule that says if you drop a piece of food on the ground, it's still okay to eat as long as you pick it up within 5 seconds. I talked with her in October and first asked her to give me the history of the 5 second rule.
History, well, it marked down that it was from Genghis Khan, but he didn't refer to it as a 5 second rule. It was stated that he referred to it as the 20-hour rule.
The 20-hour rule?
Yes, but wow. We don't know if this is certain because it's not really marked down in history. But from some research, we found that.
Well, how did it change from 20 hours to 5 seconds?
I don't know. I think maybe back in his day, people were a little more frugal with their things. And as society and everything increased with technology and innovation, that people just started not to care about things as much as people did in the olden days.
Now, you did this study about the 5 second rule as part of a summer apprenticeship.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about this apprenticeship and how you decided to pick this particular thing, the 5 second rule, to study.
Okay, it's entitled the Research Apprentice Program at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And it's for 7 weeks, it's paid, internship. It's really nice. And it's an individual project that you do with you and your mentor. And your mentor is usually a grad student. So the two of you have to conduct the project. They give you a particular field. Mine was food microbiology, so we had to find a project that would correspond to that. So my mentor actually thought of the 5 second rule, and we couldn't find any research on it. So we had to create the research on our own. And we thought it would be a really good project because it's really practical and a lot of people can relate to it. Because we did a survey to see if anyone has heard of the 5 second rule. If they have they ever applied it? And if they have applied it, what kind of foods were they confident about eating off the floor?
And of course, I mean, the whole idea of the 5 second rule is the idea of food contamination and what is, you know, still safe to eat.
Right.
Does it matter what type of food it is?
Yes, that plays a large role. It depends on the texture of the food, and believe it or not, it depends on the texture of the tile.
Okay, so like, give me an example. What sort of food would be more likely to approach the end of the 5 seconds and people still pick it up, and then what foods would hit the ground immediately and people would forget about it?
Okay, an M&M, for example. A lot of people would just wipe it off and eat it, as opposed to an oyster.
I guess that's right. You don't want, you know, it hits the floor and gets all slimy, and
yeah.
It's kind of slimy to start with.
Right.
Does gender make a difference?
Gender? Well, from our survey, women were more likely to eat from the floor than men.
And did you sort of speculate or find out why that is?
No, I didn't. The survey was only taken at the University of Illinois, and from our results, the women were just 64% more likely to eat from the floor than men.
Hmm. Are you hoping maybe to broaden this out? Or do you have questions? Maybe the 5 second rule applies differently across the country.
Yes, maybe it does. I'm sure it does, in fact.
Uh-huh, and across the world as well.
Right.
It's a cultural thing. Do you follow the 5 second rule?
I do on occasions.
Yeah?
It depends on what the food is, right?
So what are you more likely to pick off the floor?
Candy or or cookies, something of that.
Yeah, there's a trend there, isn't it?
Right.
The more desirable the food. So if you dropped what, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, people would like, yeah, you know, we'll just leave it there, right?
Yeah, they would most likely throw it away.
So what do you plan on doing with these findings?
Well, actually, I didn't expect to go this far.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people at the program, they do really good projects too, and none of their projects has ever went this far. So I thought that after the program, it would be the end, but I'm just going to let it go as far as you possibly can. A lot of newspapers are publishing the article and everything, and I've been on my local news, and I'm going to be on MSNBC today, and CBS is coming to my school next week to interview me.
Did you ever think that this summer project would blossom into so much publicity?
No, I never thought so. But I'm really happy it did because I worked really hard over the summer. It was probably my hardest summer because it was just so much work involved every day.
So why do you think everybody has picked up on this 5-second rule and has gravitated towards you and want to talk to you about this?
I think because no one has ever really did a project on it, and a lot of people can relate to it. It's not like a lot of people do projects, you know, things like DNA and stuff, but a lot of people don't care too much about DNA. But about eating food off the floor, from our survey, a lot of people do it, and a lot of people are interested when it comes to things that they can apply to their everyday lives.
So what's next for you?
What's next?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Just more high school.
Yes, my next big thing is to graduate from high school and to go to a great university.
That was Jillian Clark, a senior at the Chicago High School for Agricultural Sciences. She spent her summer here at the University of Illinois studying the 5-second rule. This is Sidetrack. I'm Jason Croft. Ever wonder just what the people of a community know? Well, this last summer, artist Anna Callahan interviewed residents of Danville to create an encyclopedia, which is not exactly about Danville, but is certainly of Danville. Here's Jim Meadows and his report on the Danville Community Encyclopedia.
The Danville Community Encyclopedia looks like it might actually be a specialty encyclopedia about Danville, but there are few entries actually about Danville, Illinois. There are no entries about the Vermilion River, the old Chuckles Candy Factory, or famous figures from Danville like Dick Van Dyke and House Speaker Joe Cannon. Anna Callahan, the encyclopedia's editor, says it's a common misconception to assume her book is devoted to information about Danville.
Actually, when people would first come in to do an interview or to talk about it, a lot of people thought, you know, you want me to tell you something about Danville. So that was, a lot of people had that same feeling. But it's more about a record of people that are in Danville at this time and kind of what people are thinking about or what's important to people, to give sort of a community snapshot in some way.
The Danville Community Encyclopedia, then, is not about Danville, but what people in Danville know and wonder about. Danville residents contributed the entries, and whatever they said in the interviews Callahan recorded went into the encyclopedia's pages and onto a compact disc included in the book. Skim through the tracks on the CD, and you'll hear a cross-section of what people in Danville are interested in.
And then they had dance halls in town, and I learned how to dance. My sisters were all dancers, and Marlette's was the one place I can remember the name of. And he'd teach us how to dance. One, two.
Now, Pakistan has always been afraid of India because India wants to be a military power in this area and uses.
I was in admissions for a number of years, where these people were coming right in off the streets, and they would be acutely disturbed. So it is difficult.
And then Bruce never overcame his demon, so he died. Like, supposedly the demon killed him, because nobody knows how he died. He just slipped into a coma, which is really, uncommon for someone who is that healthy. And so his son, Brandon Lee.
They asked me how old I am. I said, well, I'm going on 75. They said, really? Yeah, in another 6 years, I'll be 75. Well, I do that I get tired of walking around town or wherever and seeing people frown.
What I do, I look for the highly vocal, the most boisterous, biggest troublemaker in the area, and those are the ones I begin to pull in and begin to work with to show the significance of using that type of energy in the community to make social change.
I know a lot about respect. If someone's talking, you want to pay attention to them, hear what they have to say, then when they're done talking, you can talk.
That last voice is an example of the surprises in the Danville Community Encyclopedia. At least it was surprising to Callahan.
There was another young lady, Jessica Pitchin, and she was probably in fifth grade. But she had these wonderful things to say. Like, most people come in and they tell you about how to do something or, the history of a particular country or some sort of factual knowledge. And she came right into how to respect people or how to be a good friend. I mean, that was wonderful stuff to have in there, but it's something I hadn't even considered being part of the encyclopedia.
As you might suspect, the Danville Community Encyclopedia is not a commercial venture. It was Anna Callahan's thesis project for her master's in fine arts degree at the University of Illinois. The Danville Public Library is one of the encyclopedia's sponsors. They recently held a reception to mark its publication. It was an intimate afternoon affair, maybe a couple of dozen people attending, most of them contributors to the encyclopedia. There were refreshments, displays about the varied interests of some of the contributors, and a little talk from Callahan, where she explained how she got the idea for the project by first thinking about libraries as sources of knowledge, which led her then to think about encyclopedias.
So I decided to make an encyclopedia, but I wanted to question the idea of knowledge as not being just facts or history or, knowledge that's, been checked and is, correct. So I wanted to have an encyclopedia that was more people's personal knowledge, things that were important to other people, especially people living in this community.
No boring factual stuff, in Callahan's words, but there is a lot of factual material in the Danville Community Encyclopedia. You heard the entry from the man who was 6 years away from being age 75. That's from Jack Goodner, who also supplied an entry about being a Navy torpedo man in the 1950s.
Well, first you have to go through submarine school, and then I was asked to go to torpedo man school, which I wasn't really crazy about. I wanted to get into electronics or something, but they needed somebody with a high mechanical ability, so they volunteered me to the torpedo man school. And so I was a torpedo man for the rest of the time I was in the Navy, which is very, very interesting. I believe I could write a pretty good book about it. In fact, I might think about it sometime.
There aren't what you would call famous people among the contributors to the encyclopedia. Perhaps the best-known person, best known in Danville, that is, would be local activist Gloria Thompson Brown. She hopes her practical comments on activism and public housing will inspire others.
I'm hoping that it has a great impact and maybe start more people, especially younger people, to consider becoming more involved. We need more heroes and sheroes around in this community. We need people to become more active and not just stay in and look out for themselves. You need to reach out and see what you can do to assist someone else.
Thompson Brown was invited to contribute to the Danville Community Encyclopedia by Danville Library Director Barb Nolan. Other contributors responded to posters in the library and ads in the Danville Commercial News, which also co-sponsored the project. But 18-year-old Andrea Lighting, who you heard talking about the legend of the curse behind the death of martial arts movie star Bruce Lee, just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Actually, I was doing a speech paper for my speech class in high school, and it was about Bruce Lee, and I was looking up some information on him, and I was at the library, and she's come up to me and asked me if she could ask me a few questions, so I started talking to her.
Anna Callahan says that's how she got a lot of her material, by walking up to people in the library and asking them if they'd like to be interviewed.
A lot of the times when I approached people, a lot of the first reactions were, I don't know anything, you know, I don't have anything to share, or you know, I don't know anything special. And usually, a lot of times I was able to convince them that I'm sure that they did have some sort of special knowledge, and once we did the interview and began talking, we always discovered something.
From dozens of people coming together largely by chance, Anna Callahan compiled hundreds of encyclopedia entries. Besides the ones already mentioned, there are others on hairstyling, Christian music, quilting, wrestling, both amateur and professional, how to be caring, bone marrow transplants from someone who's had one, the Floral Hill Chapel at nearby Hubston, and three pages on Canada. David Wiggin, with the Texas-based sculpture exhibitor Sculpture Works, another co-sponsor of the encyclopedia, sees an almost mystical bond between the contributors.
It's amazing, because what's happened is you've got this group of people that are all strangers, and because they've all been interviewed by this one young lady, they're all sitting here as though they share a common thread. They're human beings standing here understanding each other a lot better than they did 4 months ago before they ever interviewed with Anna. Now they all feel like they have a fellowship here, or relationship to one another.
Callahan says 250 softbound copies of the Danville Community Encyclopedia, including the CD, have been printed. And there's one hardbound copy. It can be viewed at the Danville Library, where it's mounted on a special wooden stand, along with a CD player for listening to the CD. Library Director Barb Nolan says she imagines that years from now, when people have forgotten the publicity for the project, library patrons will come across the encyclopedia knowing nothing about the idea behind it.
I think they might be puzzled at first, because people are so ingrained as to what an encyclopedia is that your teacher wants you to consult. But I think once people start reading it, and they hear what people have to say, and they hear what they've shared, I think it will lead them on to other subjects. I think it will lead them into the library to further explore the subjects that they've read about in Anna's encyclopedia.
As for right now, Nolan says when she reads through the encyclopedia, she hears in her mind the voices of her neighbors in Danville. I'm Jim Meadows.
Still to come on this Best of 2003 sidetrack, Winter War, and a visit to the Renaissance Fair. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to the Best of 2003 Sidetrack. Because of this next interview, every September 19th will be forever circled on my calendar. Why, you ask? Because that is International Talk Like a Pirate Day. The two guys responsible for this are John Bauer and Mark Summers. I talked with them at the beginning of September and asked them first what is the most important thing to remember when talking like a pirate.
Probably the most important thing is having the right piratitude.
Paratitude? Is that
what
you
mean? Paratitude.
Okay.
Which means everything you do with a bit of a swagger and a growl. For instance, just the word "r," you know, which is an expression of surprise or an expression of boredom
or delight.
Or delight.
Pretty, it's pretty much the pirate equivalent of "oi."
Yes, it's your all-purpose, huh? but "r," if you say "r" with a growl, then you have the right piratitude.
And by piratitude, I think he also means, or we also mean. Pirates tend to be non-apologetic for who they are. They are who they are. Arr.
So how did International Talk Like a Pirate Day get started? And I guess, first off, we should say when Pirate Day is, Talk Like a Pirate Day is.
Well, Talk Like a Pirate Day is September 19th, every September 19th.
And how did this get started?
Well, it's probably the first holiday to start as a sports injury. We were playing racquetball, and one of us, we can't remember which of us, probably went for a low shot and got hurt and let out an "r." And the next thing you know, we were saying things like, "Arr, me matey, slap it off the mizzenmast," you know, that sort of thing.
That be a fine cannonade. Watch this broadside. "Arr."
Arr.
Because that's the kind of thing guys do.
I guess that's very true. But why pirates?
Because it's fun.
It's fun.
Do you need any other reason than that? It's fun. I mean, we considered, well, we could do, like, Talk Like a Guy from Jersey Day or Talk Like an Accountant Day. None of them were fun. Pirates are fun.
Now, where did you go to get the material, the source information to talk like a pirate? Is there a pirate dictionary out there? Is there classes you can take to talk like a pirate?
Our main source of research was probably Domino's Pizza.
We're guys, we don't do a lot of research.
Yeah, our research involved more beer and pizza than actually looking stuff up. People would I mean, some of this is stuff that guys just know. They just pick it up in their childhood. Some of it people would email us you just pick it up from other people in conversation and kind of nod like you know what they're talking about and figure it out later.
Once we opened our website, www.talklikeapirate.com, we found a whole bunch of people out on the World Wide Web who are into pirates and into pirate talk. So there may not be an actual, like, definitive dictionary, but we have a pretty good vocabulary list, and there are other sites that have terrific vocabulary lists.
There are other people who take pirating more seriously than we do. We are pirate guys, which I think is a slightly different take on it.
You're not true, actual sort of pirate, recreationists, reenactors. Yes.
No.
Because that again, we're guys, and being a pirate reenactor and worrying how many stitches would be in this kind of thing—that's too much work.
That would involve too much work.
We're actually just—we think the idea of a day when everybody talks like a pirate is funny, and that's what we're pushing.
So September 19th. Is there any reason why you picked that date?
Yes, there is. Well, first, now the fateful racquetball game actually occurred on June 6th, 1995, when we said, "Oh, of course, Talk Like a Pirate Day." But then we realized, oh, man, June 6th is D-Day. And that's, you know, sort of a sacred memory thing. You don't want to bollocks that up. So I said, we need another day.
And so I came up with September 19th because I was recently divorced at the time, and it's my ex-wife's birthday. And I wasn't doing anything else with that day anymore, but it was stuck in my head. And I thought, well, at least we can remember that from year to year.
And thank gosh we did.
So why do you think that pirates and talking like a pirate is so much a part of guy culture, has really clicked with guys like you guys?
Well, I would say first because it is fun, because it's a chance. How many chances, let's say you work in an auto parts store or an insurance office, how many chances in your day-to-day life can you swagger? can you just be boisterous and crazy? Probably not a lot.
And we need to be clear that we have kind of extended the meaning of guy to go beyond just gender. There are lots of pirate guy wenches out there.
And women, first they look at you like, oh, God, not this again. But women kind of like it, too, because you have to call them me proud beauty. And they enjoy that. My wife certainly does.
Have you guys always been fascinated by pirates? Is this something you guys did when you were little boys?
No, like most things, we just kind of stumbled onto this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure I spent some time thinking about them as a kid, but I was, I don't know, I was more into cowboys and soldiers myself and sports.
And I did play pirates as a kid a lot with my brothers. I lived in Seattle growing up, and so growing up on the water there, you just kind of get a nautical theme going in your play.
See, I'm from Chicago. It's not the most nautical place in the world.
Well,
but
Chicago, you know, Chicago is only a few hours north of here.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
We've got Lake Michigan. I don't know if there are any pirates on Lake Michigan.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Well, how do people react to this day when you say, yes, I have started International Talk Like a Pirate Day, ARG? How do people react to that?
Well, first of all, our friends all think it's very amusing. They are also dumbfounded that the rest of the world is paying attention to us.
We get emails from as far away as, like, England and
Australia,
Ireland. It's all over the place.
And people don't even bat, at least the ones who contact us about it, don't even bat an eye. They think, oh, what a great idea. Arr.
Well, explain how this little thing that just happened between the two of you guys blossomed into this whole worldwide thing.
Well, first of all, we have to thank Dave Barry. It's the power of Dave Barry, the syndicated Pulitzer Prize winning columnist. Back in 95, when we first had the idea, we were standing on the racquetball court, and we said, you know who needs to know about this is Dave Barry. And then we did nothing.
And then, like, 8 years later, you know, we got right to it, and 8 years later, John wrote an email to Dave Barry telling him about our idea.
And he wrote a column, and I used to work for the newspaper, and the features editor called me at work and said, John, I'm editing Dave Barry's column this week, and it's about... Is this you? And it was. And we thought, well, this is very funny. This is okay, there's our 15 minutes of fame. And it just kept going. And it just kept going. And, gosh, now we've got a website, and we're trying to sell a couple of books, and it's just crazy.
I think it meets a need for whimsy.
It does. It meets a need for whimsy in what could be a very bleak world. Very dark and dangerous place. So here's some whimsy.
But that's kind of ironic because pirates themselves were rather dark and dangerous to start with.
Bad pirates. We acknowledge this. Pirates are and were bad people, did bad things. We do not advocate people acting like pirates. We just think people should talk like pirates because that's funny.
You know that there is a student organization here at the University of Illinois, where we originate from,
mm-hmm.
that is named the ARG I'm a Pirate Society.
Well, good for them.
What advice would you have for these young buccaneers?
Okay, the first advice I would have is there's a great debate in the pirate world. Is it AR or is it ARG? We maintain that it's AR with no G at the end. If you say ARG, that's a sound of pain, like you just sat on a belaying pin. But R is just a growl, a hearty
exclamation.
Noise you can make.
So there is this big debate.
Huge debate.
On diction, is there any other words that have the same sort of problem when it comes to pronunciation, to pirate diction?
Boy, mostly not that I'm aware of. I think people mostly understand what you mean when you say ahoy or avast, or although I have been chided for saying avast meant look at that when it actually means stand and give attention, which I think means look at that. there are words like forecastle and mizzenmast that nobody knows, you know, especially if you're from Chicago, exactly what that means, but you know it's something nautical, something to do with a ship.
And again, we haven't given it a lot of research. We just kind of play.
Yeah, how many? We are both. I don't want to say middle aged. What is men of some maturity? We both have responsible, serious jobs and families and children and all that stuff. How many chances do guys like us get to play? That's what we're doing. We're playing.
So if people want to learn more about how to play like a pirate and talk like a pirate and International Pirate Day, tell them the website again. And
it's www.talklikeapirate.com.
And it's September 19th. Mark it on your calendars. Is there like a something you would like everyone, maybe a saying you would like everyone to say at the same time on September 19th?
Ooh, that's good. Well, September 19th this year falls on a Friday, so there's a tremendous opportunity for parties.
Yeah.
And we were thinking about, you know, lines you might use at a party or at a bar or something, and 364 days of the year, guys are going to walk up to women and say something like, "Hey, babe, what's your sign?" But on September 19th, I want you to stride up there with a manly swagger and say, "Arr, prepare to be boarded."
That works both ways. Women can say that to men, too.
Yes, they can.
Well, John and Mark, thanks for talking with me about International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Thank you.
Arr, it was our pleasure.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. During the first weekend in February, every year, dozens of battles take place from medieval castles to historical battlefields, and they're all staged within a few hotel conference rooms of one another in Champaign. Last year, Tom Rogers went to the annual Winter War and had this story.
It's a Saturday afternoon at the ballroom of the Chancellor Hotel, and the fates of whole imaginary armies are being decided on surfaces the size of ping pong tables.
This is a reenactment of the Battle of Borodino in 1812 between the Russians and the French. And the French are trying to stop the Russians, and the Russians are not necessarily doing too well.
This is not Chutes and Ladders. The miniature playing fields, props, and warriors are often the products of hours of historical study and exacting duplication. Many of the gamers here wield a mean paintbrush. Don McKinney of the Conflict Simulation Society is Winter War's organizer.
And you can look at the level of detail on the individual figures. I mean, down to the symbols on the flags and how the individual uniforms are painted on the individual figures. And recognize that the scale here, I mean, each figure represents multiple men, but still the level of scale and detail on the figures is very, I mean, and if you just, for just a moment, see they've gone to extraordinary work on the in detail. Yeah. So I'm not that patient. I could not do this, but it's incredible work.
If I have time, I like to spend my time gaming.
Mike Davis isn't just a gamer, he's a high school principal. He's trying to explain a game on the other side of the room, one set around an elaborate mock-up of a castle. It's a popular game called Fantasy Siege, set to slightly different rules, half improvised before the meet.
For example, we had a ladder up in the wall here, and the first figure went up. Okay, he did win a combat and dropped down, but they gained the initiative next turn. That's when you roll the dice. Initiative is who gets to go first. And within a turn, it goes back and forth, and that's determined by a die roll, and it's a minus one to the side who went first previously. Well, by doing that, the defending people chose to go first, and justifiably so, because they were able to surround that figure.
Such rules can be hard to grasp for someone who's never been a high-level gaming enthusiast. But for all the intricacy, Davis says the game's really simple because it's all based on a roll of the dice.
Plus one versus your plus two. Orc gets a four. Good shot. Splat. Okay, next guy is a plus zero. One.
That's a good rule system. It's very, for public demonstration games like this, it's excellent. It's very straightforward. It's very simple. A couple of turns, it's running itself, basically.
The simplicity and the fantasy of it all can make an interested bystander a devoted gamer rather quickly. But some people just don't understand that devotion. Gamers may never have attracted the same envy in high school as athletes or cheerleaders or the other beautiful people. There is, after all, a stigma attached to people who spend a lot of time strategizing at a table over figurines or cards or fictitious conversations. But Mike Davis, the high school principal, says most gamers really do have lives away from the table.
If I have outside real life things to do, I take care of them. I also like to fish. I like to go to sporting events and so forth. So I like to get together at cons like this. For me, I've been doing this for a long time. It's more I'm just seeing people from around the state that I ordinarily maybe see two or three times a year, and we catch up.
Think of gaming enthusiasts this way, like people who play other games of strategy and chance, say poker, for example, or collectors of items like guns or train sets or neon beer signs. Those hobbies don't carry nearly the same societal baggage. Gamers find their joy in activities that combine the interests of the collector and the interest of the poker player. In fact, the term gaming geek has become a term of endearment within the fandom. McKinney says conventions like Winter War add the element of social interaction.
From the university perspective, we've got former alumni who come as far away as Washington State to come back to the university and come back to our convention. You know, there are people who've been here all 30 years of the convention and remember that first time. Or, you know, and they're here to see who's back and how everybody's doing and what's going on.
McKinney hopes Winter War grows next year, 31 years after its modest beginning on the U of I campus. The internet and the explosion of online gaming aren't having much of an impact on the phenomenon.
Online has allowed us to find each other better. And to be honest, most of these people, we might dabble in that, but I don't think a lot of our audience is that audience. There's some crossover, and I know a few people here who do that, but by and large, we want to be face-to-face with the people we game with. We want to know how they're doing, know who they are. I'm not big on gaming with people I don't really know.
With so many people wanting that personal contact in combat, Winter War isn't going to reach a permanent armistice anytime soon, and the Battle of Borodino will rage on. For Sidetrack, I'm Tom Rogers.
The next Winter War is scheduled for February 6th through the 8th. To find out more, stop by their website, winterwar.prairienut.org. You're listening to the best of 2003 Sidetrack. This last Labor Day weekend, the Champaign County Fairgrounds in Urbana, an area that is usually used in the summer for demolition derbies, livestock judging, and carnival rides, was transformed into an Elizabethan-era Renaissance fair. It was organized by the Prairie Players Theater Academy. It featured a royal court, jousting, period music, and more. I stopped by there and talked with those involved.
All ye here attendant to my voice, all hail and God save the Queen of England, Elizabeth the First. God save the Queen.
God save the Queen.
With heart, God save the Queen.
God save the Queen.
I'm Jo Marie Dugan, founder of Prairie Players Theater Academy. I established the academy in 1997. It's a program for youth ages 9 to 18. And this year we needed to do a fundraiser because we had lost our venue where we had been holding our programs. So I thought of something that would be unique and different to the community, that would be benefited to the community as well as our program. So I selected the Renaissance Fair, being a fan of that period in time in history, knowing a lot of people enjoying Ren Fairs throughout the country. So that's where the idea came, and it started about last October. And I started putting the wheels rolling, getting the process going, contacted some people in the Renaissance Circle for some assistance as how to go about putting a Ren Fair together. Much to my surprise, there is no manual on how to put a Ren Fair together. There will be in the next year or two because I plan on writing one. I've learned a tremendous amount. But it's a unique experience. It's for everyone. It's a cultural event. It's a history event. It's a fun event.
This Ren Fair, this is not a one-shot event for you guys. You're hoping to keep this going.
Absolutely. Our goal is to continue with this each year to the point where we will be able to build a permanent site. Permanent site meaning that you own the property, your vendors start building their own buildings there, and it becomes permanent. But I want to take it one step further than just being a permanent site for Ren Fairs. I want to go to the next step where we offer a performing arts school along with it. So in the summertime, we do the Renaissance Fairs as our fundraiser, but throughout the year, the building facilities is used for community events, it's used for education, it's used to bring the arts back to life in our community.
So what sort of person does it take to reenact this time period in history?
It takes someone who has a love of that time period. It takes someone who likes to play. Play means that you like taking on a character and you like researching your character and having fun with the language and the history and nuance about that time period and how you should act and how you should behave. It takes you out of this current modern technology age back into a more romantic period in time.
My name is Dean Geiken. I'm the, so to speak, president, if you want to call that, or leader of the Order of St. Sebastian. In the reenacting world, I'm the captain of these archers here, and we were invited to come and display our archery prowess and our knowledge of the 14th century, primarily 14th century England. And we have not only just archery, we have a history demo area where we can show off different types of weapons and methods of warfare during the 14th century. And my wife, Cordelia, also has quite a nice setup for cooking and you know, more of the daily activity stuff during the 14th century. We have bow makers who are making actual longbows that we use. We make the stuff we use. We have a lady of leisure over here working on a tapestry using period stitching methods.
Well, why don't you show me around the exact things here? Your encampment here at the end of the Renaissance Fair.
We've got Three Rope John and James Lewis, both who do a fine job of making bows. They make bows.
Explain this device down here.
The device that we're looking at right here is called a bow horse, and what it does is by sitting on it and using pressure with the foot, you can make a vise of sort to hold the wood, and then they can use draw knives or rasps or something like that in order to take bits and pieces of wood off of a stick and turn it into a longbow. They also make their own strings. We make our own arrows. John right now is reworking a bow that he recently acquired so he can basically resuscitate and rejuvenate an old bow that might not be usable and turn it into something that's very good. These boys, you really shouldn't get too close to them because these archers are actually ne'er-do-wells. Many of them happen to be criminals, much like this one over here. But, you know, if they shoot a bow well, we'll give them a pardon.
They are using what's called a matchlock arquebus or musket, depending on what word you are used to. It is a smooth bore, which means that the barrel is just as smooth. It's a big piece of metal, that's all, with a hole in it. They are going to use match. That's what it gets the name for. The match is what is going to ignite it. And they put a burning match. It is a treated. It's a treated cord so that it will burn and smolder slowly. They will put it here on this little piece. All of their muskets have them. Some of them are built slightly differently, but what they will do is there is a pan. They will open the pan and they will put a little bit of gunpowder here and they will close the pan. They will blow it off or tap it. You will see them do that to make sure that any excess powder not within the pan is blown away so that nothing accidentally happens. It wouldn't set the gun off, but it might burn their eyebrow off. Almost as bad. Then they will put the gun down, put the powder in. If we were actually shooting at things, you would also put a ball in here. And you can either use the ramrod to take out and shove it down, or in cases of battle, you just tap it on the ground. It's a little bit faster, and you want to get this thing firing as fast as possible, eh? They would then bring it up. You would aim. Move the pan out of the way so that it would be exposed. You would aim, turn your head away, and fire.
My name's Shane Adams. I'm playing Sir Shanton of Falcon's Hill. I am the field marshal for the joust.
And explain what's going to go on here today.
Well, today, in favor of Her Majesty the Queen, we'll be having one of her father's, King Henry VIII's, most favorite pastimes and things to do, the joust. In the modern day world, we have three world champions here to perform for the crowd. We have Lloyd Clark, the champion of Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin. We also have James Merrilees from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. He's the reserve grand champion of the WCJA, which is the World Championship Jousting Association. And I'm 7-time world champion Shane Adams.
So explain sort of the accoutrements here. What do you guys use, and how do you actually perform the joust?
We perform the joust the same way it was performed back in the years of old. Basically, these knights are full contact competitors. They will be jousting the same way the knights jousted back in the days of old. This is for real. This is not a choreographed show. The lances we use are solid wood, and when they break, it's because of the force of the hit, not because the lances were meant to.
And you got the horses, too. You got everything here. About how fast can you ride, and sort of what impact do those lances make?
Well, basically, you take a weight of a car. You know, basically, a horse weighs about 1,800 pounds. You put upon him a knight that weighs 400 pounds, with the armor and all the other, you know, all the other instruments such as the lance and the shields. That's about 2,500 pounds colliding at a speed. Well, basically, the horse is traveling at 30 miles an hour against the same opposing force. Therefore, that's a collision of 5,000 pounds at 60 miles an hour. Now, this isn't just a car wreck. This is a train wreck.
And it causes a lot of bruises, doesn't it? So what does it take for someone to get involved in this and to be motivated to come out here and get the wrong end of a lance week after week?
Well, my mom, when I was really young, dropped me on my head. And ever since that time, I've been looking for the same childhood feeling of that pain, of that solid force of impact. So therefore, the only way I was able to find it was within the joust. But realistically, these knights are just a couple of kids living their dreams.
They are now coming about and charging at your will. My lords and ladies, 1 point scored for each knight. My lords and ladies, they are prepared for their second run. And charging.
Sounds from a Renaissance Fair, held at the Champaign County Fairgrounds during the Labor Day weekend. The fair was organized by the Prairie Players Theater Academy. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Join us again the first Wednesday in February for another edition of Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.